With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Amid summer heat, farms focus on keeping employees safe. In 2005, following farm worker deaths in the Central Valley, California established the nation's first heat safety law for outdoor workers. Since then, California has tightened its heat illness prevention standard, which remains the most stringent of the few such state laws in effect. The law includes requirements for shade, water, and rest, as well as a heat acclimation process for workers. Joe Del Bosque, who's farmed in the Central Valley since 1985, says, quote, "We're trying to make our employees more aware of these dangers and how to protect themselves." That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. The Department of Pesticide Regulation has released the results of an independent study regarding the mill fee. The mill, a fee paid by pesticide retailers or manufacturers when a pesticide is first sold in California, is the department's primary source of funding. The study looked at proposed structures and rates to provide long-term sustainable funding for the department. DPR's director, Julie Henderson, says, quote, "This study highlights the urgent need to provide short and long-term funding for the department to continue to improve protections for people and the environment and ensure the availability of safe, effective pest management tools." She added, quote, "The way pests are managed impacts human health and the environment. The department needs effective, long-term, stable funding to ensure pest management approaches across the state protect people and the environment and support agriculture, community well-being, and our wildlands." According to DPR, in January of this year, a group of diverse stakeholders released the Sustainable Pest Management Roadmap for California to chart a course for pest management approaches in the state that address human health and equity, consider broader environmental factors, support community well-being, and safeguard the future of our agricultural and food supply sector. The recommended mill increase would provide needed long-term support for fundamental department work and fund the accelerated statewide transition to sustainable pest management. This increase would also fund pesticide-related programs at CDFA and the pesticide enforcement programs on a local level that are implemented by county agricultural commissioners. Cal EPA Secretary Yana Garcia says, quote, "To truly build a healthy and safe California for all, we must transition to sustainable pest management and decrease our dependence on high-risk pesticides. That includes ensuring DPR has adequate long-term funding to expedite the registration of safer tools and improve the evaluation of current registered pesticides." The study found that DPR is underfunded, which threatens its ability to continue operating its current programs and future programs that support the development and implementation of safer, more sustainable alternatives for effectively managing all types of pests. Thus, the study recommended a phased-in mill increase from 0.021 cents for every dollar in sales up to 0.0339 cents per dollar in sales. In addition, the study also recommends the consideration of a futured tiered mill structure to support and incentivize sustainable pest management. To take a look at the mill study, you can visit cdpr.ca.gov. And now here's AgNet West Brian German with more agriculture news.
The late spring rains pushing production timelines back by a few weeks may have ultimately helped some growers get through the tropical storm that just hit California. Fresno County Farm Bureau CEO Ryan Jacobson described how early season delays affected the impacts of the recent storm system.
"We are fortunate because of that being behind. We didn't see as much of our perishable commodities on the ground, such as raisins and almonds, as in a normal year. And so they were probably able to sustain the rains better simply because they were on the vine or tree versus being on the ground compared to a normal year."
While a bit later than average, it's now going to be a busy couple of weeks as harvest really gets going.
"Harvest for almonds really got started here in the Fresno area last week. There was exceptions. Some people started earlier than that, but traditionally I'm looking third, fourth week of July, we start to see the early ones going, and by first week of August, things are really humming. I would say now we're getting to the point this week where things are really going to get humming. There were a few folks, for example, that slowed down harvest towards later part of last week, or they slowed down the shaking just so the nuts weren't on the ground when the storms came through. They're really going to get going this week, and things are going to be full speed ahead with just about every one of our commodities here in the valley, as you know, all of our fruits and nuts and so many of our crops come within this 6 to 8 week period that we're harvesting so many of them there. So it is go time for them to really try to pull those off in a little shorter period than we're typically used to.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, smoke from Canadian wildfires has shown up in many parts of farm country around the nation throughout the summer of 2023. Seth Knave, extension agronomist with the University of Minnesota, says the smoke's effects on U.S. crops is not easy to describe.
Yes, the overall quantity of light is reduced. But one really interesting thing about crops is that the upper leaves of crop plants can't absorb all of the light that's incident upon them. There's two or three times as much intensity of light than those first leaves can absorb. Therefore, leaves below them receive a little bit more, and then a little bit is transmitted through the leaves. It goes down to the next leaves. And by the time you get down in the canopy, the leaves are fully shaded.
And the smoke affects the sunlight that the plants need for photosynthesis.
What happens when we have partially overcast skies is the light is actually scattered. So instead of having light coming through directly, and it's like what you see when you get a hard shade around leaves under a tree or something like that. Instead, when we have some overcast skies, the light is completely scattered. So it's basically coming from all directions. And that allows the light to penetrate down in the canopy, and we're able to better distribute the light throughout the canopy instead of it being basically nailed in the first level of leaves.
He says even though the smoke does limit the overall amount of sunlight getting to the crops, but it does spread that light more evenly throughout the plants.
It can pass through those leaves and even out the distribution of that light throughout the canopy. So that's a well-known physiological principle that goes back decades that old physiologists have done work on this. So there's actually some balancing effect on that. And recently I saw a publication, and I didn't dive into the citations on it, but there's also a light quality effect in that the smoke is taking out some of the green lights and leaving some of the red spectrum that are more useful for the plant. And so although the light quantity is reduced, the fact that it's coming through as scattered light and the quality of that light is actually slightly improved, most of the physiologists agree that there's probably little or no detrimental effect on crop plants per se.
It's not entirely positive, as the burning wildfires create a byproduct that is harmful to crops and humans.
The only bad piece of this stuff for plants is ozone. So we've all heard of ozone, and that's this reactive oxide that comes about by burning. And if ozone levels are increased, that has some detrimental effects on plants. So that these little radical oxygens kind of disrupt the individual cells, some parts within cells, within the plants. And so it could have a negative effect.
In other news, the latest USDA pasture and rangeland conditions report shows the usual dryness found in late summer. Here's USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
Taking a look at USDA NAS topsoil moisture numbers for the week ending August 20th, 47% of the nation's topsoil moisture is very short to short. That's up 5 points from the previous week, and the surplus number has dipped to 3% nationally, down from 6% a week ago. One area that does remain wet is much of the northeastern U.S., particularly New England. Vermont, which was hard hit by flooding a little over a month ago, remains quite wet with another round of rain. 72% surplus is the number coming in out of Vermont. But a lot more of the country is reporting dry conditions. This week coming in number one on the list is Texas, 94%, very short to short. All other plain states except for South Dakota, Wyoming, and Colorado are also coming in greater than 50% this week. Then in the Northwest, Washington State leads that region, 91%, very short to short. Not too far behind is Montana, 79%, and Oregon, 72%.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, the American Lamb Board's July market report is now available. The report indicates that both lamb imports and domestic production are down. The report notes lamb weights are lighter than a year ago, and fewer imported pounds have resulted in a lower supply of lamb in the domestic market. Federally inspected lamb and yearling slaughter for July is 4% lower than 2022, and July production is about 10% less than last year. But one positive number is mature sheep slaughter. It's lower than 2021, but averages 5% higher than last year. That's being driven by larger coal ewe numbers in Arizona, California, and Nevada. But the report shows imports are significantly lower, which means more American lamb accounts for total lamb supply so far this year. Lamb imports were down 20% from last year for the first half of this year. Mutton imports for the first half of this year were reduced by 23%. The Livestock Marketing Information Center is forecasting stronger prices, with feeder lamb prices about 3 to 4% higher and slaughter lamb prices up 30%. You can see more of this report on the American Lamb Resource Center website, lambresourcecenter.com. Well, according to new data from USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, most cow-calf operations in the U.S. remain relatively small and have fewer than 50 cows. NAS says at the other end of the spectrum, a few very large operations with more than 1,000 cows can be found. The data indicates that between 1997 and 2017, most cow-calf operations remained small. In 2017, 54% of farms where beef cows had fewer than 20 animals. That's down slightly from 1997. But during the two decades, the overall number of cow-calf operations in the U.S. dropped 19%, while the average herd size on the remaining operations did grow. These changes in farm numbers and herd sizes, while notable, have not been as significant as industry shifts in hog and dairy production. The combination of relatively lower cow-calf-specific startup costs and pastures as primary source of feed has resulted in a variety of operation sizes. And the National Cattlemen's Foundation is now accepting applications for the annual W.D. Farr Scholarship Program that was established back in 2007. The scholarship recognizes outstanding graduate students pursuing careers in meat science and animal agriculture. Now, two $15,000 grants are awarded to graduate students who demonstrate superior achievement in academics and leadership and are committed to the advancement of the beef industry. Scholarship recipients recognize that the program not only benefits their work, but also the entire industry. Graduate students must apply online by September 22nd this year. The 2023 scholarship recipients will be recognized at the Cattle Industry Convention in Orlando, January 31st through February 2nd. If you'd like more information and to apply for the scholarship, simply go to nationalcattlemansfoundation.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Unused prescription opioid pain medicines can spell trouble. They can spell risk if taken by someone they weren't prescribed for. Harm if accidentally taken by a child or pet. Or overdose if they're not used as directed. Safely dispose of opioids before they can hurt your family. Find a drug take-back option such as medicine drop boxes. You may find these in your community at local pharmacies or police stations. Visit www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Ensuring the integrity of child nutrition programs. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. USDA Wednesday published a final rule on program integrity to ensure that child nutrition programs are properly operated and managed to protect federal funds and taxpayer dollars. The final rule impacts the National School Lunch Program, School Breakfast Program, Special Milk Program, Summer Food Service Program, and Child and Adult Care Food Program. The final rule introduces targeted flexibilities in the National School Lunch and School Breakfast Programs that streamline monitoring requirements and lower administrative burdens for states. The rule also finally finalizes provisions in the child and adult care food program that have already been in place. These provisions streamline processes, provide additional resources, and increase accountability. The rule also allows for more efficient use of state agency resources by ensuring that organizations at risk of serious management issues receive more frequent oversight and that financial transactions are appropriately reviewed. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCullough. In a recent tax court case, the IRS claimed that a part-time farmer wasn't really a farmer because he used old tractors. But the tax court said the method he chose for farming didn't preclude him from being a farmer for tax purposes. The IRS audited a part-time farmer and claimed that he really wasn't a farmer because he used numerous old tractors that were mostly 40 to 50 years old. He worked full-time as a UPS driver and farmed both before and after his shifts. Over the years, he acquired 5 non-contiguous farms totaling about 500 acres. The farms were several miles apart, and he kept certain tractors at each of his farms with implements attached to save him time and effort. He also personally did the maintenance on the tractors. During the audit years, he bought 29 tractors and fully depreciated them in their year of purchase. The IRS claimed that his tractors were for personal purposes because he was an antique collector and denied the depreciation and other costs related to them. But the tax court disagreed, noting that his chosen method of farming over a long period of time allowed him to avoid debt and do his own maintenance. While the court disallowed some depreciation due to errors, the case points out that you are allowed discretion in how you want to farm. But make sure you maintain good records and don't commingle your personal and business expenses. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCullough.
And in more agriculture news, cost-share programs included in the Farm Bill help farmers and ranchers tackle expensive projects. Michael Clements shares more with a farmer from Maryland.
The many programs of the Farm Bill help farmers and ranchers improve the environment while producing food for the nation. Maryland Farm Bureau member Joanne Chasen says Farm Bill programs helped her when moving livestock to new land about 10 years ago.
Here in Maryland, we treasure the Chesapeake Bay, and therefore we have strict regulations on nutrient and natural resource management. I was required to fence out a pond on the property. This resulted in me also having to install a geothermal well-fed water fountain so that there would be a constant supply of water for the livestock. For a small operator as myself, this was a costly undertaking. It was incredibly helpful to work with NRCS, who cost-shared the project with me.
With the Farm Bill expiring, Chasen says lawmakers need to act quickly to pass the next farm bill.
When faced with regulatory requirements that are indeed good for the environment, it often leads to costly projects. Farmers across the nation rely on cost share programs to help them meet the requirements that might otherwise be cost prohibitive for them. And the current farm bill is set to expire in about a month. It's imperative that as soon as Congress returns in early September, that they prioritize the passage of the new farm bill.
She encourages all farmers and ranchers to tell their lawmakers the importance of the Farm Bill.
Call, write, and email your congressmen and senators. My representatives have told me that they want to hear from their constituents and that firsthand experiences and personal stories make the biggest impact. Keep it honest and real, be yourself, and just tell your story. And the bottom line is we all have to work together to get this over the finish line.
Learn more at fb.org/farmbill. Michael Clements, Washington.
An extension of recent efforts to advance U.S. trade, particularly farm and food trade, in Africa. How Agriculture Deputy Secretary Sochil Torres-Small describes a recently announced agricultural trade mission to Angola.
Angola is one of the largest markets in Africa, and with imports making up more than half of its food market, Angola is a perfect location for U.S. exporters to introduce more American-made products to African consumers.
The Deputy Secretary leads the U.S. delegation during the November 28th through December 1st mission. She notes the travel is the latest in a series of federal efforts to expand U.S. export opportunities on the African continent.
It's building on President Biden's U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit, where the administration is working to expand and deepen our relationship with countries on the continent, also expanding efforts through increased training and technical support for their Continental Free Trade Agreement, and expansion of trade through a recent trade mission to Kenya and Tanzania. Negotiations with Kenya, a regional leader, have also started for the Strategic Trade and Investment Partnership. partnership.
As for why Angola is a promising market for increased sales of our nation's farm and food products.
In 2022, U.S. food and agriculture exports to Angola totaled $236.8 million, which made it the seventh largest American market for U.S. exporters. Angola was also the largest U.S. poultry market in Africa and the sixth largest globally last year, importing more than $232 million of American poultry and poultry products.
Applications are now being accepted from U.S. exporters wishing to participate in the upcoming trade mission.
The deadline for exporters to sign up is Friday, August 25th. This is for exporters, which can be distributors and farmers, folks who are looking to expand their market into Angola. We'll also be looking to make connections for folks in neighboring countries of Democratic Republic of the Congo and the Republic of Congo.
With more information about the Angola and other ag trade missions available online at www.fas.usda.gov/topics/trade-missions. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Hot temperature is declining after today. We think the grain trade will be declining next week as well. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report to end the week, brought to you by Helena. Farm Progress Show opens Tuesday in Decatur, Illinois. Highs there today will be at or near 100 degrees, but by Tuesday's open, highs will barely reach 80. Nebraska State Fair opens today in Grand Island, Nebraska. Forecast highs in the mid-90s, but all next week, highs won't get past 85 degrees. And this is repeated across the country, with a few areas getting a brief shower. So weather, plus pro farmer showing corn and soybean yields near USDA, will put pressure on futures the week ahead. Corn in December, we think, will trade closer to 480 than 490. November soybeans should find support below that 1350 level. December, Kansas City wheat will follow, but lower, but hold the 748 level. Keep an eye on Wall Street the week ahead if the Dow can hold above 34,000 following Chairman Powell's remarks today in Wyoming. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day and a profitable week ahead.
Things are heating up over the EATS Act. Supporters of the bill say the Ending Agricultural Trade Suppression, or EATS Act, would prevent states from regulating farmers and ranchers nationwide. Mary Thomas Hart is the chief counsel with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
It prohibits a state like California from passing a law that would impact production practices in other states. And then in the event that a state does kind of get away with passing a law like that, it gives a farmer in another state a cause of action.
But opponents turned up the fire this week when a bipartisan group of more than 150 lawmakers sent a letter to the House Agriculture Committee Chair, G.T. Thompson. The letter states, quote, "The act could harm America's small farmers, threaten numerous state laws, and infringe on the fundamental rights of states to establish laws and regulations within their own borders." Read the full story at agnetwest.com. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
What is the outlook regarding our nation's peach crop? Lance Honig of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service begins with an assessment of California's crop this season.
A little too much rainfall, believe it or not. Cooler than normal temperatures, that's not great for the crop.
Leading to a 7% reduction in total peach production, with Freestone variety production expected to be down 4% from the previous forecast, and Clingstone production down 12% from the prior forecast. Meanwhile, in the southeast,
both South Carolina and Georgia dealt with some freeze situations,
resulting in production reductions of 66% in South Carolina and 78% in Georgia. The result for U.S. peach production this year?
Peach production expected to be off 13.2%. That's the lowest production in more than 15 years.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Here's part of a song from a classic 1950s movie starring the incomparable Rita Hayworth.
The heat is on. The heat is on. The heat is on.
That song from 1953 could well be the theme song for 2023, or at least the summer of 23. Several weather and climate agencies around the world have been saying already.
The globe is coming off of its hottest July and hottest month on record.
And Agriculture Department meteorologist Brad Rippey says the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, has just echoed those findings. After taking a look at global air and ocean temperatures for July,
they were running more than 2 degrees Fahrenheit above what we saw on average during the 20th century from 1901 to 2000.
Now, of course, we've all seen a lot of news about record-breaking heat in places like Phoenix, Arizona, but Brad Rippey says the heat has been on in many places around the U.S.
From Texas and eastward along the Gulf Coast into Florida, it has been one for the record books.
For example, back on August 14th,
we saw our 37th consecutive day of 100-degree heat in College Station, Texas. Previous record, 30 days, was set in 1998, another memorably hot summer. We have already set an all-time annual record for the number of 100-degree days in New Orleans prior to this year. We've never seen more than 5 days of 100-degree heat in New Orleans at the International Airport, and we've already doubled that this year with 10 days of triple-digit heat. So really brutally hot conditions, building since mid-June and really reaching a crescendo here in August, with triple-digit temperatures in areas that are typically kept a little cooler by the water proximity of the Gulf of Mexico.
Ah, the water, that brings us to what is helping fuel this heat wave. Rippey says, yes, air temperatures are breaking records, but
a lot of that warmth is being driven by incredibly high oceanic temperatures.
Not just in the equatorial Pacific, but around the world. Rippey says warmer oceans send more moisture into the warmer air, creating
heavier rainfall events, more rain falling in a short period of time. And that can actually contribute to more runoff and can lead to flash flooding and river flooding.
And we are certainly seeing more of those events this summer, along with deep, long-lasting droughts and more deadly wildfires, such as what hit Maui the other day.
This is shocking, but it's not surprising. It's what was predicted, 20 or 30 years ago.
Dr. Andy Pershing with the independent research group Climate Central says until we get worldwide reductions in greenhouse gas emissions down, more and more future summers could look like this one, only maybe worse. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Irrigation in arid California is as complicated as it is essential. Unpredictable supplies, uneven distribution, complicated application schedules, and regulation make it a challenge. No wonder help with water is the biggest request at USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. Since 2014, NRCS has invested over $100 million helping over 1,000 California farmers conserve water. By using superior technology and savvy management, farmers get more crops with fewer drops. Join the Water Savings Club. Contact your local NRCS office. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back to the show. For today's interview segment, we have part two of my conversation with AgSafe President and CEO Teresa Keene. Our topic today is all about the wage rate increase that is taking place next year. As of right now, the minimum wage is $15.50 per hour. Next year, starting January 1st, it increases to $16. We're talking all about the implications of that and what she's hearing from employers on how this increase may impact their operation. Teresa, now is this something that is more or less like a one or a two time increase? Or is this something that now employers are going to have to think about year after year as our economy continues to go up and go down? Is this something that they're just going to have on the tops of their minds to pay this much, if not more, for good quality help?
Right. So I would suggest, and we've been warning our employers about this as well, like you're going to need to think about those increases every year. So that 3.5 is always in there. So think about when you're doing that budget, like it can go as far up as that 3.5%. And also, you know, there is a ballot initiative looking at increasing our minimum wage to $18 an hour. So I feel like, you know, minimum wage in California is going to continue to increase, and we're going to have to, you know, get really strategic with how we utilize our workforce and, you know, are there other options available to us?
What are you hearing from growers when it comes to this kind of news? Are they issuing concern at all over how they're going to keep up with the increases and pay all of their employees, you know, this amount of money? Are they thinking about how these increases will impact their operation? I would assume that with an increase in the minimum wage rates, that probably means there's going to be some changes in overtime pay as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. Coupled with the increases in minimum wage, we have also been going through the overtime as well. And so kind of being hit from both sides. And I think operations are having to really sharpen their pencils and figure out how they get this done. And I think a lot of operations are also starting to think about ways to implement and utilize technology to help reduce down the load in terms of employees. So I think it's really forcing our operations to really take a look at what they're using in terms of technology, but also employees, and having to be really, really thoughtful and moving forward to stay afloat.
You know, with the minimum wage increasing to $16 an hour next year, and maybe even potentially $18 an hour in the coming years, what's to say, Teresa, that a current agricultural worker will take up something less laborious and work, I don't know, let's say indoors or at a fast food eatery where there's AC or as a retail associate where there's AC, you know, rather than being outdoors in the heat or having to work in a field or in a packing house and doing that skilled but laborious work? The industry is already facing a shortage of quality workers. I don't know. What are your thoughts on this?
I think it's already been happening. I think we're seeing a shift, and especially if there are other industries that are offering higher wages. And so I feel like you see some of our, even though it's still usually outside, but folks moving over to construction where they might get a higher wage. And I think that's where the ag industry is starting to like really pull together and begin thinking about how we train our workforce and really thinking about how we can upskill our labor force. And so providing opportunities for them to learn new things within those operations, thinking about those technology skills that they might need to run equipment and those opportunities to perhaps make a bigger jump on the pay grade. And I've been hearing a lot more about that and our agricultural communities partnering with our community colleges and others to provide some of those additional trainings, some of those really skilled trainings, so that there are more opportunities. And let's be honest, we've got a fantastic workforce.
They are so dedicated and very skilled. And so if there are some opportunities that we can provide to them so that they stay in ag, we keep them, that retention is so critical.
Okay, again, one more time, Teresa, give me a rundown of what's to come in 2024, what people should keep an eye out for when it comes to wage rate regulations and ballot propositions, and if you could, where folks can go to stay up to date on this rule as well as other workplace safety rules.
Oh, absolutely. So 2024, yeah, remember that minimum wage increases beginning January 1. It's going to be $16 an hour. And then factor in around the July, August timeframe that you will probably hear about, good heavens, 2025. And so be paying attention to that and know that increase will probably be in there when we get the information. And if you have any questions in regards to regulatory compliance, for safety, for human resources, feel free to reach out to us at AgSafe, and you can go visit agsafe.org.
All right, Teresa, thanks so much for talking with me today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Danielle.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Why do we have GMOs? Actually, we've been modifying crops for thousands of years to prevent crop loss from pest and weather damage, to grow more food on less land, even to improve nutrition. Today, GMOs are developed for the same reasons. With genetic engineering, scientists can change and improve crops more easily and quickly. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Growers interested in climate-smart agriculture can get free assistance from UC Agriculture and Natural Resources. Community education specialist Katty Bergren said the Climate Smart Agriculture program can be an important resource for producers.
We can help with any questions about eligibility or, you know, how to answer a certain question on the application. And then as well, if a grower does get funded through the program, we can help if they have questions along the way about how to do their paperwork through CDFA, or even if they have a question of, you know, what are the best cover crop seeds for my situation, or how do I plan a hedgerow to plant? Any of those kind of questions, we can help just to make sure a grower is successful with their project. So we provide completely free assistance all over the state. So we can do it, you know, remotely over the phone, or there's 10 of us who have this position throughout the state based in different counties. And we're able to provide on the ground assistance for free for growers in all the counties that we serve.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
USDA announces funding to support U.S. specialty crop producers. USDA's Agricultural Marketing Service on Wednesday announced $72.9 million in grants awarded to 55 states and territories through the Specialty Crop Block Grant Program. The grant provides funding to enhance the competitiveness of specialty crops, as well as support specialty crop growers through marketing, education, and research. Fiscal year 2023 funding is awarded to the Departments of Agriculture in the 50 states, the District of Columbia, the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, American Sonoma, and the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands. States are encouraged to subaward funding to projects that address the needs of U.S. producers of fruits, vegetables, tree nuts, dry fruits, horticulture, and nursery crops. Funded projects include investing in food safety, specialty crop research, including research to focus on conservation and environmental outcomes, developing new and improved seed varieties and specialty crops, and pest and disease control. This year's award marks over $1 billion invested in nearly 12,000 projects supporting the U.S. specialty crop industry. NAFB contributed to that report.
The California Rice Field Day is scheduled for Wednesday, August 30th at the Rice Experiment Station in Biggs. Sponsored by the California Cooperative Rice Research Foundation and University of California, the Rice Field Day is aimed at providing rice growers and others an opportunity to observe and discuss research in progress at the Rice Experiment Station. Registration and post-reviewing will begin at 7:30 with a general session set to begin at 8:30 consisting of the CCRF Annual Membership Meeting, Rice Research Trust Report, and the California Rice Industry Award. Field tours of rice research will begin at 9:30 and will feature presentations on weed control, variety improvement, disease resistance, and insect control. In addition to the informational field tours and poster displays, a rice equipment vendor display is also being planned. More information about the field days available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
Forecasting grape and cranberry production. What is the outlook for two fruit crops this season per USDA's August crop production reports? Well, USDA's Rod Bain talks with Lance Honig of the National Agriculture Statistics Service in this next report.
Grapes and cranberries, among the fruit commodities covered in USDA's August crop production reports. Lance Honig of the National Agricultural Statistics Service says for grapes,
up 6.1% year over year. That's actually our first year-to-year increase since 2018.
With the breakdown in the largest grape-growing state, California, showing wine grape production up 12% year over year. Raisin grapes down 3% and table grape production up 4% from the previous year. Turning to cranberries,
our friends in Wisconsin looking at their fifth lowest production on record, and we're also down in Massachusetts this year.
Those states and their cranberry crops impacted by early season freezes and snows, as well as frost and hail during the growing season. The national cranberry production forecast is expected down 5.4% this year. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.